The benefits of Buddhist practice are varied, the many different benefits that come. But hopefully, there are benefits to be had in each moment of practice, or each day of practice, so that you're not looking towards some great goal, you know, some great ideal goal of liberation or enlightenment as being what's going to fulfill or make a whole endeavor worthwhile. That it's worthwhile in each step along the way. And that each step of the practice that you take feels right, feels satisfying, brings happiness, brings benefits. So you have no regrets for what you've done, even if you maybe don't attain the top of the pyramid. Happiness is really central to the Buddhist path. Some of the different other elements that are central to the Buddhist path, like concentration, are dependent on being happy. The right concentration, the right kind of concentration for developing the path for meditation, comes from a sense of deep well-being or well-being within us, a kind of happiness. The pursuit of happiness is considered to be one of the great pursuits in Buddhism, one of the very worthwhile things to do. And it's enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, right? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is what Americans are about. And so Buddhism is perfect for that. The Buddhist analysis of happiness perhaps is a little bit different than that of corporate America. What Buddhism is looking for is reliable happiness, happiness which is healthy, worthwhile happiness, happiness which maybe is long-lasting or reliable for a long time. And there's a lot of things that people pursue for happiness which are not very reliable, not very stable. And a lot of people have pursued things that thinking that those things are going to make them happy. And they might make them happy for a little while, but then after a while they don't. I've heard enough stories about people who win lotteries who end up being miserable. It must be somebody's happy, but if I'm winning, I hope so. But, you know, life changes in many ways, and things we depend on our happiness on, which are external things, might be taken away from us in all kinds of ways. In order for a reliable happiness, from the point of view of Buddhism, is one that has a lot to do with the cultivation and development of our inner life. And there's forms of happiness that can come from our inner life and from how we live our lives, from our integrity, which tend to be much more stable than the happiness that comes from having certain clothes or certain cars or certain houses or certain partners or whatever it is that people think they need in order to get happy. And so for this long-term happiness, Buddhists will point towards inner cultivation, changing ourselves as an important part of that, and looking for reliable forms of happiness to rest on. But happiness is still the pursuit. The full liberation, nirvana, is sometimes called in the tradition the great happiness, the mahasukha. Now, I know some people are troubled by the idea that happiness should be part of a spiritual pursuit because it can seem selfish. And it seems like there's all these people suffering in the world and it seems self-centered to be focusing on my happiness. And my suggestion is that that view is a legacy of a certain kind of Western view of Western idea about self and others, about spirituality, that lend itself to kind of very strong emphasis on divide between being selfish and altruistic, where in extreme forms, being altruistic, you wouldn't focus on yourself at all. You just kind of sacrifice yourself for others. And if you don't sacrifice yourself for others, then you're being selfish. You're just being self-centered and self-focused. In at least in Indian culture, in Indian Buddhist culture, which our tradition comes from, there was no such strong divide between self and other in this way. And there was a very clear understanding that cultivating great happiness, reliable happiness for any individual, for oneself, was benefiting others also. And that and benefiting others benefited oneself. And you didn't have to do this sacrifice of one for the sake of the other. You didn't have to sacrifice your own well-being because you're supposed to be altruistically of service to others and make others' happiness first. Others' happiness was dependent on you being happy. And your happiness, to some degree, was dependent on others, to some degree. But mostly, what you can work on is your own happiness. And that your own happiness is a great gift to the world around you. It's a really great benefit. And I feel very lucky that my father told me that when I was quite young, kind of one of these lessons I grew up with, where he said something like, something very vaguely like, you know, what the world needs is more people who can share their joy with others, who are joyful and are models of joy. And if someone wants to be a great musician, that if they bring joy in the world not necessarily through their music, but they bring, they're joyful in doing their music. Their joy then is a benefit for others. And so this idea that our own happiness is something that benefits others is very important. It's said in maybe more unhappy terms in the tradition by saying that if two people are stuck in quicksand and one person says, well, I'll help you, and they try to lift the other person up, well, they're both in quicksand, so that the person doing the lifting will be pushed down further into the quicksand. The other says, no, I'll help you. And then that person tries to lift the other person. Then they get pushed down further. Because that's the nature of quicksand, right? You kind of just. But what has to happen is one person has to get up onto the dry, solid ground, and then you can pull the other person out. So if we cultivate happiness for ourselves, it's understood to be a great offering, a great gift to the world around us. It helps other people to bring them along and to discover happiness and what is happy. Happiness in Buddhism is not a selfish goal. In fact, selfishness in Buddhism is understood to be a form of unhappiness. So if the pursuit of happiness is through the filter of selfishness, it's probably going to be a dead end. But I don't want to say that then it should be a selfless pursuit of happiness, because then in the Western ears we'll misunderstand what that means. And we'll think, oh, I'm supposed to just sacrifice, not paying attention to myself. So to be happy and to want to be happy is considered to be very healthy in Buddhism. Now, there are unhealthy ways of wanting to be happy. That we have to be very clear about. But that doesn't mean that they're not healthy ways of wanting to be happy. And wanting to be happy can be very healthy and very appropriate, and the Buddhist tradition would say is a natural, normal part of a healthy life, is to want happiness for oneself and for others. So the orientation of a Buddhist life, every spiritual life has to have an orientation. And if a person is trying to live a life where the whole life is oriented around the ideals or the practices of a tradition, they have to understand what that orientation, you know, what the orientation of the tradition, the values of that tradition are. In the Buddhist tradition, one of the primary orientations has to do with this issue of happiness. What is it that brings happiness to my life? What is it that brings happiness to other people's lives? How can I support both? How can I develop both? Sometimes that is worded in the negative. And one of the key teachings of Buddhism is wording this in the negative. Which is what's known as the Four Noble Truths, where the Buddha emphasizes that there is suffering in the world, and there's the cause of that suffering, or conditions for that suffering, and then there's a possibility of ending that suffering, and there's the conditions for bringing about that end. Some people get kind of depressed when they hear that good news of Buddhism. But they think the Buddhists are talking about suffering all the time. Give me a break. Now, there's a great story of when some people from Menlo Park, I think it was Menlo Park, here in Peninsula, in about 1965 or so, went up to San Francisco. They were four teenage girls. I think they were 14 years old or so. And apparently LSD was big, you know. Ken Kesey was, you know, he was a local yokel, right, over there in Menlo Park. So I don't know exactly, you know, how they learned about LSD, but they found out that in San Francisco there was a Zen master who could teach them how to get high naturally. So they took the bus up there and went to see Suzuki Roshi. And they told him that they asked him, we're here to learn how to get high naturally. And he said, great. And he proceeded to give them a teaching about the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and then the Eightfold Path. And it wasn't what these girls had gone up to learn about. But for one of them, the one who's my friend, she said, the way that Suzuki Roshi talked about suffering was so happy that caught her attention. And she became a Zen student down to this day. 40 years later, she's still practicing Zen. Because how happy he was, talking about suffering. You know, it depends how you want to word it. You want to look at it positively or negatively. But the advantage of looking at it negatively is that, you know, at suffering, which Buddhists love to do, they like to be very honest about suffering, is then you can be really realistic about what keeps you from being happy and what the path to happiness might be. If you go to the doctor and something ails you, and you have this 15-minute appointment with the doctor, and the doctor asks you about what sport you like and your hobbies, and you know, have you been watching the Giants and how they're losing, and you know, you look at your watch and you have, you know, 10 minutes left and 5 minutes left, and the doctor's still asking about your hobbies, and you know, 2 minutes left, and you know, you don't want a doctor who, you know, asks you about good news or bad news or something, you know, that kind of. You want a doctor who asks you about what ails you. You know, that's what the whole point is, right? The doctor can't help you unless you tell the doctor where you're hurt. So the same thing in Buddhist life is that you have to really understand where you're hurt and to be honest about it and wise about it in order to develop the path. You find the path, in a sense, by being honest about how you suffer. So that means that the happiness project of Buddhism is not meant to be kind of a sugar-coated kind of positive thinking, kind of looking at everything on the bright side and ignoring what's, you know, the difficulties of life. It's by going through the difficulties and being very honest about them that we can begin finding a more reliable and healthy form of happiness. But if you understand that happiness is the reason you're doing that, then you can be maybe lighter about it. You can feel more hope about it, rather than being pulled down by it or depressed by what you see and what you find out. So a very important, very central part of the Buddhist endeavor is to have a view or an orientation of what the Buddhist life is about. You have to be able to see it. What is the Buddhist life about? If you don't see what it's about, you won't find it. If you can't find the path, you won't be able to step on it. So the first thing Buddhists need to do is to find the path, to see it. And it's found very simply in this dynamic between happiness and suffering. So being very honest about both, being very open to both, and being willing, interested in letting go of suffering, alleviating suffering, diminishing suffering, bringing suffering to an end, and developing the happiness, developing the joy, the delight, the gladness, the sense of well-being that can come. Sometimes we focus more on happiness and the cultivation of it, or the sensing of it, or experiencing of it, or tuning into it. And sometimes we focus more on the suffering. And a part of a wise life is to know which one to focus on at different times and how to focus on it. So in order to find the Buddhist life, we have to begin to appreciate happiness and suffering and be willing to look at both of them very honestly. Some people are unwilling to be honest about suffering, and some people are unwilling to be honest about happiness. I don't know who you are. I know some people who felt there was something sinful about experiencing joy, their own joy or happiness. It was kind of goes against their religious upbringing to do that. It's nothing wrong about feeling happiness in Buddhism. It's something to be really cultivated and developed. The Buddha was sometimes called the happy one. Isn't that great? The happy one. And sometimes people, Buddhists, forget, you know, the happiness side. It's true. So I apologize for the Buddhists. Because we talk about suffering so much. But that's a little bit unfortunate. But, you know, luckily you're getting the happiness thing on the first day. You know, and that happiness project can take different forms. Different people have kind of different vocabulary if we're talking about it. Some people will talk about it in the vocabulary of compassion. Compassion has to do with suffering and alleviating suffering, wanting to help. So they'll use that kind of language. But it comes to the same thing. You know, the alleviation of suffering, the motivation to alleviate suffering, isn't supposed to be some neutral state. You know, great, I alleviated all the suffering in the world, and now everybody's walking around like zombies. You know, they completely have no affect. That's not the point. The point in the compassion movement to alleviate suffering is hopefully to bring people to not, you know, a flat state, but rather the capacity to feel great happiness and joy and delight in life. So some people have different vocabulary that's different from what I'm saying tonight, you know, about happiness and suffering. They use compassion, perhaps, for it. Some people like to use the word peace or freedom or liberation for this. But I would suggest that they're all kind of different angles of talking about the same thing. And the reason why I want to emphasize happiness so much is that it's a lot safer to do Buddhist practice if you remember to look for and develop the happiness at each step along the way in all that you're doing. I think it's a healthier kind of practice with that in mind. The second aspect of the practice is, once you can see what the path is your intention to step on it, your resolve, or your, to say it a different way, is to begin living a deliberate life. A Buddhist life is a deliberate life. It's not a life that's only about just letting things be as they are and stepping out of the way and being one with everything and just letting the bulldozer run you over, or the equivalent, or whatever. There's certainly a very important part of mindfulness practice in Buddhist life, especially at the top of the pyramid, about being very equanimous and very allowing of things just happening as they happen. But at the same time, living a deliberate life is very important. And at the base of the pyramid, living a deliberate life is kind of like one of the main things we're doing, is finding out how to be deliberate, how to be resolved, how to have an intention and act on that intention. So the bottom of the pyramid is having the right orientation, the right view, right understanding what we're doing, understanding what we're doing. If you don't understand what you're doing, it's very hard to build the rest of it. If you don't have the map for the pyramid, you know, the plans, the architectural design, it's very hard to know how to build a pyramid. So the bottom of the pyramid is the map, the understanding of what you're doing. And then it's the intention or the resolve to follow that map, to engage in that construction, that project. So a deliberate life. Okay, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'd like to do. It might be a 10-year project. It might be a 10-lifetime project. I don't know how long it's going to take. But I've been told each step along the way is satisfying, so that's okay. I'll just pursue it. And I'm going to start organizing my life so that it supports this project, supports this endeavor, this cultivation, supports my maturation, this gradual development, maturation, like a child develops to an adult, so an adult develops to, you know, to someone who's a mature spiritual being. I'm going to live a life that supports that development. And then how motivated are you for that? Is this something you're mildly motivated for? Are you going to be a weekend Buddhist? There's the publishing world has a phrase called nightstand Buddhists. Maybe some of you are nightstand Buddhists. And, you know, I don't want to be, I'm not at all critical of nightstand Buddhists. I mean, that's fantastic. I mean, imagine reading these great things and being inspired by it and falling asleep with that. It's really, you know. You know, you can, you know, it's easier to do a lot worse. That's great. But how motivated are you? And to look at your motivation, to look at what motivates your life. Are you motivated more by television? You spend more time watching television than you do meditating or actually actively pursuing a spiritual life? If people came from Mars to study you, anthropologists from Mars, and they couldn't really see your inside of your mind what you did, but you just kind of decide what, you know, what the key motivating factors in your life based on what they observe, what do you think they'd conclude? Television. You know, wow, it's the great, you know, the great religion. These people spend more time in front of the altar of television than they go to church on Sunday. It's quite amazing. So what motivates you? Why does that motivate you? What, you know, what are the key organizing motivations for how you live your life? A deliberate life is one that looks at what motivates you. Everybody has motivations. What motivates you for the work you do? What motivates you for what you do in your free time? What motivates you in the conversations you have? What motivates you with you know, when you go to sleep, or, you know, all kinds of things, the food you eat. There's all kinds of motivations involved in that, intentions. To look at motivations is the second layer of the pyramid. It means being very honest about the motivations that actually make you tick, your operating software. And then to evaluate, if are these really the motivations you want to live by? Or are there other motivations that actually, if you really delve deep inside of you, have more meaning for you? What occurs to me now is I've known people who've gone to medical school with a very deep motivation to be of compassionate service to the world. And there's something about how American medical training is that puts so much stress on people that at least a couple of people that have told me this, for the, you know, I don't want to generalize, but for a couple of individuals, they say that after 7 years of medical school and all the debt they have and everything, that their motivation to be of compassionate service is receded far to the background. And other things are actually more the motivation they're living their life on. To pay back their debt, you know, to all kinds of things. The compassion is no longer on the forefront. Sometimes there's things that end up on the forefront of how we actually live our life, that if we spend time actually thinking about it or reflecting deeply, we don't actually want them to be there. And we might actually want other motivations to be in the forefront. So what motivations for your life do you want to have on the forefront of your life? What do you feel is really important? If you knew that how you live your life today will shape your life in 10 years, how will you start to shape it? One of my favorite little analogies in Buddhism is that of two lines which are almost parallel. You know, they're almost parallel. So if you look at them, or if you follow them along, they would seem like they're parallel. They go along, you know, no difference. But if there's little degree difference between them, in the short term, you don't see a difference. But after 10 years, they're miles apart. because they grow more and more and more further apart. So a small change in our life today can make a big difference in 10 years. It's a little thing we just start doing differently. Don't underestimate the value of a small change. And if you do a bigger change, the change over time goes faster. So to look at our motivation, to look at what makes us tick, and to begin evaluating, is this really how I want to live my life? Are there other ways, other things, other motivations around which I want to live my life? In a Buddhist spiritual life, deliberate life is one where we're really motivated to do something about suffering and happiness for oneself and for others. And to make it one of the central motivating factor in one's life. That having a better job, having a better bank account, having a better relationship, having a better health, having a better quality of life, better recreational opportunities, a better house, a better paint job on their house, those would be, take second place to the pursuit of happiness. That is reliable, long-term, and it helps to develop create long-term happiness. So, you might get happy if you paint, your bathroom. It might make you happy. It might make you happy for a while. But I suggest it's not really the same kind of reliable happiness that comes from having cultivated your capacity to be kinder, your capacity to live with integrity, your capacity to live with a kind of healthy discipline, to be able to have some control over the mind and its impulses. There's happiness that comes from developing one's inner life. And that inner development is considered in the Buddhist tradition to be more reliable over the long term. A very common story that many people will tell is having something. James Beres tells a story about a cheesecake. And he could have eaten that cheesecake piece on a retreat. Someone gave him a present, it was a birthday or something. And he could have eaten that cheesecake and experienced the happiness of the pleasure of eating cheesecake. That's good, right? And that happiness would have receded in memory very quickly. And he probably in 10 years, he wouldn't even remember that he got the cheesecake or barely remember the happiness of it. But what he did instead was he cut up that cheesecake in different pieces and gave it to others. And on retreat, meditation retreat, getting a piece of cheesecake is really good. Even if it's just a bite. And 10, 20 years later, whatever, he says, he still experiences the happiness of that act of generosity that he wouldn't have experienced if he'd just eaten the cheesecake. The happiness of eating cheesecake is a lesser happiness or a shorter-term happiness than the happiness of giving the cheesecake away. So that kind of equation, that kind of reflection or thought is one thing Buddhists try to reflect on. What is long-term and what is short-term? What is beneficial for long-term, what is beneficial for the short-term? Buddhists have their sight for all the emphasis that Buddhists have on being in the present, here and now. There's cliches, there's jokes about it. There's a whole culture around making jokes of Buddhists being in the present, the here and now. For all the importance that Buddhists have in being in the present, Buddhists also have their sight on the long term, of what they're doing to develop themselves in a year or 5 years or 10 years at the same time. So a Buddhist life is also a deliberate life. So I offer you these teachings today in the spirit that during this next week, you're going to reflect on them. You're going to think about them. You're going to talk to your friends about them. You're going to challenge them. You might criticize them. You might, engage with them. Make them your own. Buddhism doesn't exist apart from you personalizing it. And Buddhism is not Buddhism unless you are yourself. So it's not a matter of you becoming different than who you are. But there's a dynamic there of engaging with it. Engaging with the teachings and finding yourself and the teachings together. So the teachings today have to do about happiness, the orientation of your life, what you see as the purpose of your life, what you see as the possibility in a human life, the possibility of happiness, the possibility of lessening your suffering or ending suffering, and the teaching about motivation, the teaching about looking at your motivation, questioning your motivation, prioritizing your motivation, discovering what you really want your life to be about. If you reflect on these things as the bottom of the pyramid, then it'd be a lot easier to follow through on the next layers of the pyramid. So I would hope that you reflect on this, think about it, talk to friends, talk to others about it, bring up what they think about all this. And that reflection will help for next week, I hope. So is that adequate for beginning? I apologize for not giving any time for questions. I'll stay around a little bit if some of you would like to just come up and ask questions. I think it's important to have it go both ways. But that's enough for today. So thank you very much.